Chapter 13. Mormotha, Divinus Prime. They thundered across the plains, trailing a great mountain of dust as they screamed between the penitent trees. The priests of Tarn Abbey had left a surprisingly powerful array of vehicles behind, and, as dawn turned the bleached landscape into a kaleidoscope of reds and golds, Antros saw their destination, rushing towards them out of the heat haze. He was hunched in one of the eagle-proud skiffs they discovered in the abbey. They were antiques, elaborate constructions of iron and brass that no one had expected to work, but the priests had obviously treated them as holy relics. Their engines had a deep, powerful growl that filled the morning with noise and fumes as they hurled the blood angels along, gliding just a few feet above the ground. Raceless was next to him, staring into the dust storm trailing from Mephiston's craft. Behind them, the two priests, Zin and Brennus, were lying on the floor, clutching onto the spars that lined the hull. Captain Vitrinus and some of his tactical marines were standing, legs wide as they braced against the lurching motion of the vehicle, their bolters raised and trained on the shapes blurring past. Mormotha was constructed in the same ossuary fashion as the abbey. But as the rising sun painted it in warm, golden hues, Antros saw that Divinus Prime's capital was built on a much grander scale. The entire city was contained within a circular curtain wall, hundreds of feet tall, and punctuated with gun emplacements and missile batteries. Antros could see the silhouettes of soldiers on the walls, carrying banners emblazoned with the sigil of Divinus Prime, a winged sword hilt, and others bearing the symbol of the Adeptus Ministorum. Unlike Tarn Abbey, Mormotha was perfectly intact. The bleached walls matched the macabre beauty of the penitent trees, the curved, bone-construct crenellations reaching up, talon-like, into the clouds. Broad, paved roads approached the city from several directions, and they were all crowded with refugees and weary-looking soldiers. Barely a soul looked up as the skiffs hurtled past them, whipping up clouds of chalk dust. The columns of survivors just trudged on into the morning sun, heads down, carrying a pitiful collection of personal belongings and hauling their wounded on makeshift litters. An army of rickety servitors trembled and lurched through the refugees, carrying broken equipment and the corpses of those who had not survived the journey. It was a miserable scene, and Antros started to understand the scale of what had befallen Divinus Prime. He could see thousands of dispossessed souls stumbling through the barren scrubland, their lines disappearing into the distance. It was one thing to hear the Quorum Empiric discuss these wars in derisive tones, but quite another to see the consequences. There were families mingled in with priests, normal citizens of the Imperium, just trying to stay alive, hollow-cheeked elders hobbling on bandaged feet, and mothers cradling their febrile infants, all staring at the walls up ahead, with the vacant expression of people who could remember nothing but the need to keep walking. Many would never reach their goal. The roads were lined with the corpses of refugees who had died within sight of the capital. The gates to the city stood open, and there were crowds of hooded, white-robed priests waiting to welcome those who staggered inside, offering cups of water and hunks of bread as they helped them into the shade. The air was full of noise and movement, as mechanized hymnals fluttered overhead, leather-bound tomes borne through the air on broad, dove-white wings. As they flew, they broadcasted the ghostly recordings of long-dead Terran choirs. Singing along tunelessly with the hymns were the relic sellers who haunted all shrine worlds. Antros saw plump, lavishly dressed frauds with rubicund faces, cheerfully peddling holy tracts and crudely made reliquaries to wretches who could not afford to feed themselves. The Blood Angels landed their skiffs outside the gates and stormed through the noisy throng, drawing surprised glances as people saw the towering figures of Mephiston and the other Adeptus Astartes. Mephiston paused as he walked into the centre of a large crossroads. The four roads that met just inside the gates were broad enough to support a whole phalanx of tanks, but they still seemed narrow because of the soaring townhouses and temples that surrounded them. The buildings were constructed in the same funerary style as the penitent trees outside, sturdy, fluted columns supporting domed turrets and grand pediments, all intricately wrought from millions of warped, fossilized bones. The city would have looked like a mausoleum if it weren't overrun with thousands of distraught refugees, all talking and yelling at once. The steps of chapels and basilicas swarmed with crowds of bellowing, sunburned survivors, all venting their pent-up grief and anger on the officials who were trying to aid them. As they passed through the mob, Antros heard the same story repeated over and over. Cities and towns that had become slaughterhouses, bloodbath battles, as the secessionists known as the Enlightened turned on their brothers, killing those who would not embrace their new doctrine. It sounded to Antros as though many had embraced the new cult. He heard refugees mutter of family members and friends who had converted to the new faith. They spoke of them in shocked, desperate tones, calling them apostates. Antros and the others gathered around Mephiston at the centre of the crossroads, drawing more surprised glances. The Adeptus Astartes looked like an impregnable bastion, as crowds of mortals backed away from them, crying out in alarm and calling for guards.
"Even those that know its name will not speak openly of the Blade Petrific," said Mephiston, inside Antros's head. He saw Raceless nod in reply, and wondered if he was meant to have heard the words or not. "It is an article of their faith, discussed only in their most sacred rites."
Mephiston gave Antros a meaningful glance, and he realized he was speaking deliberately to him. He looked again at the crowds, wondering if he could delve into the mind of a local and find a memory that could lead them to their prize. It was no use. Whatever sorcery had shrouded Divinus Prime was still clouding his second sight. Even the attempt caused him to wince as he saw a shattered reflection of his own thoughts, ideas and hopes dredged from the recesses of his memory. The harder he tried to explore the minds of others, the more he felt as though his own mind were being examined. The sensation was deeply unpleasant. He was about to ask Racilus if he was still blind, but the commotion caused by their arrival had drawn the attention of one of the beleaguered officials.
"Hello!"
called the man, barging through a scrum of arguing merchants and reaching Mephiston. He was full of bluster, and seemed about to demand something of them, but the colour drained from his face, and he stumbled to a halt. He looked from Mephiston's corpse-like features to Racilus's imperious glare, and then Antros's inhuman beauty, and shook his head, opening and closing his mouth a few times, forgetting whatever he had been intending to say. Presta Brennus stepped from behind the Blood Angels, and the man visibly relaxed as he saw someone of more normal proportions.
"Brothers," he said, as Confessor Zinn also stepped out of the crowd. "Welcome, Tormomortha. I'm Presta Syriac. Where have you travelled from?"
He glanced nervously at the Blood Angels, noticing Captain Vitrinus and his men striding through the crowds to join them.
"And you are your companions?"
Presta Brennus stumbled forwards and grabbed his hands.
"Torn Abbey is gone," he cried. "The Enlightened crucified anyone who would not join them. They're coming here next. Oh, the apostates will tear down these walls and butcher—"
"Calm yourself, brother," replied Presta Syriac.
He embraced Brennus.
"Word has reached us of the murders at Tarn Abbey, but you need fear no more."
He waved at the crowds.
"Arch-Cardinal Dravus has summoned everyone still following the true imperial creed. 3 whole regiments of Volscan dragoons have turned their back on the apostasy of their brothers and travelled here to fight for the Arch-Cardinal.
and more loyal soldiers are arriving every day." His eyes flashed with pride.
"There are thousands of militiamen here, too. Sir Rambus is coming to meet his doom, brother. These atrocities will soon be over, and once the Arch-Cardinal has dealt with that wretched fraud, he intends to perform an even greater miracle. He means to return us to the arms of the Emperor."
"What do you mean, brother?"
asked Confessor Zinn. Prestosyriac was struggling to contain his excitement, but he managed to keep his voice low.
"The Arch-Cardinal has spent many days praying in the wilderness after the Emperor blessed him with a vision. Dravis is seeking a way to break this unholy silence that has enveloped us. He seeks a way to return us to the light of the Imperium."
Zinn glanced triumphantly at Mephiston.
"Do you see? Do you see what you've done, my lord? Your mere presence on this world has broken the curse."
"Oh, this can be no coincidence. It is as it was prophesied."
Prester Brennus slumped in Cyriac's arms, overcome with exhaustion and emotion.
"Oh, forgive me, brother,"
said Cyriac, looking pained at the man's suffering.
"I must get you to the infirmary."
He summoned one of his fellow priests over and ordered them to find treatment for the man. Confessor Zinn muttered a quick prayer over the barely conscious Brennus and promised to visit him as soon as he was able.
"Take us to the Arch-Cardinal," said Rasilus, once Brennus was gone.
Cyriac grimaced and looked to Zinn for support.
"Brother, as you can imagine, even if it were within my power, I could not simply admit strangers to the Arch-Cardinal's presence. I'm sure your companions pose no danger, but I would need some kind of..."
Rasilus stepped forwards, his beautiful, master-crafted armour glinting in the sunlight. His hulking frame threw Cyriac into shadow, and the man looked up at him in terror.
"We are the sons of Sanguinius,"
said Rasilus, clearly nauseated at having to address so lowly a specimen.
"And I assure you that we do pose a threat."
He flicked back his cloak and rested his hand on the pommel of his sword.
"Question the will of a blood angel again, and you will meet the Emperor sooner than you expected."
Cyriac backed away with a horrified grimace, his hands raised protectively. He shook his head and was about to flee when Zinn interceded.
"Prester Cyriac," said Zinn, stepping between Rasilus and the priest, "if you can inform the Arch-Cardinal that I am here, and that I am in the company of Lord Mephiston, chief librarian of the Blood Angels, he will be all too pleased to see us, I assure you."
"But he's not here," said Cyriac. "He travelled alone to the Arazai Plains. As I said, it has been prophesied that he will receive guidance from the God Emperor."
Zinn pressed Cyriac further.
"Brother, where exactly in the Arazai Plains? We must speak to him urgently. Lord Mephiston cannot be left waiting. You must send word to..."
"We will wait," said Mephiston,
studying the crowds of refugees that were staring at them. As Antros looked at Mephiston, he noticed that his left arm was shaking, and the armour was hazed by a cloud of black sparks. Mephiston followed his gaze and gripped the vambrace. He muttered under his breath until the sparks were extinguished, but his arm continued to tremble.
"Wait, my lord," said Antros.
Mephiston nodded.
"Take us to Father Orsuf."
Cyriac looked at Mephiston's arm, his eyes widening in fear, and he seemed unable to reply.
"Orsuf is alive?"
asked Rasilus, glancing at Mephiston.
"Do you know Father Orsuf?"
asked Zinn, looking confused but trying to give Cyriac a reassuring smile. He nodded at the growing crowd that was forming around them.
"It might be better if we were out of your way."
Cyriac nodded eagerly, clearly delighted by the prospect of making the Blood Angels someone else's responsibility.
Yes, of course. Of course. And I do know Father Osserf, the old preacher. But he rarely receives guests. Anyone else? I'm sure someone...
His words trailed off, and he flushed red.
He will receive me, said Mephiston.
Sariak nodded and started barging a path through the crowds, waving for them to follow.
Please forgive me for...
He grimaced.
No need to apologize, brother, said Zin,
as he and the Blood Angels followed the awkward-looking priest off the main thoroughfare. He led them away from the gates and deeper into the city. Each street they entered was a little less crowded than the last, and a little narrower. Antros quickly saw why Mormotha was known as the Labyrinth. Each concentric circle of the city was crowded with grand ecclesiarchal buildings, basilicas, mausoleums and tombs, all striving to outdo each other's macabre beauty. Their porticoed facades flooded the avenues and fountains below with confusing pools of shadow, so that Antros soon found it impossible to keep track of their route. Navigation was made even harder by the fact that every architectural detail was built of the same sinuous bonework. As the shadows grew deeper, the shapes started to look more sinister. Twisted, knotted spines, warped in balustrades and pediments, all studded with grinning skulls. The air was still crowded with winged hymnals that filled the streets with their eerie, distorted music, but they soon reached a district that was free of the wailing refugees. Hooded faces looked down at them from high, colonnaded balconies. They eyed the giants below them with blank, unreadable expressions. Cyriac led them on through a series of empty gardens and up a steep, cobbled street towards an abbey, perched at the summit of a hill that looked down over the whole of Mormotha. They had been walking for nearly an hour by now, and as they neared the imposing domed building, Antros paused to look back. Seeing the city from this vantage point revealed that the capital was even larger than he had imagined. Mormotha's bone-white maze of streets sprawled out for many miles, and Antros realized there must be millions of people inhabiting its crush of temples and monasteries. To the east, he saw the great gates and the square they had entered through, still clogged with crowds. The south was a palace complex, a huddle of buildings that dwarfed even the massive structures surrounding it. The palace buildings were linked by dozens of covered pergolas, giving the impression of a vast spiderweb, and even from several miles away, Antros could hear bells ringing in its towers. The north side of the city faced out onto a sun-burnished expanse of ocean. The calm, glittering waters were dotted with small ships, and beyond the city walls there were docks and warehouses. The western side of the city was dominated by a spaceport so huge Antros could make it out even at this distance, and near the spaceport was a colossal amphitheatre that looked to be at least a mile wide. This vast, terraced circle was surrounded by a legion of crumbling statues that looked down over the surrounding buildings with regal indifference. Everywhere he looked, Antros saw grandeur and magnificence, but he sensed a void at the heart of Mormotha. Most of the plazas and markets stood empty, and the few people who were on the streets hurried through its grand arches in silence, their heads down. The city felt like a memory, as lifeless and fossilized as the bones that had built it. As they neared the abbey, its tall panelled doors swung open, and a stern-faced preacher emerged to greet them. He limped out from beneath the abbey's arched porch and grimaced as he stepped into the light. He was thick-set and burly, but he moved with the studied slowness of the extremely old, leaning heavily on a staff. His spine was so twisted by battle trauma that he had to tilt his head on one side to look up at the Blood Angels. His head was shaven, and his face was covered in a network of old, silvery scars, surrounding a nose that had been broken so many times, it looked like an S. He looked more like a crippled old street fighter than a priest, and his ecclesiarchal robe seemed oddly incongruous. Where his left eye should have been, there was a large augmented lens, fixed in a housing of battered iron. It turned slowly in its angry socket as he tried to focus it on Mephiston.
"By the throne," he said, smiling. "Lord Mephiston."
Mephiston surprised Antros by speaking directly to the abbot, addressing him in respectful, almost warm tones.
"Father Orsef," he said, "I heard a malicious rumour that you had retired."
Orsef scowled with embarrassment and tried to straighten his spine so he could offer Mephiston a salute.
"My chainsword is still oiled and ready, Lord Mephiston, hanging on the wall of my study. It would be an honour to join you in battle once more. An honour! It has been too long since we fought together."
Mephiston gripped the old man's shoulder.
"I am joking, Adamis. You serve the Emperor more fiercely than any preacher I ever saw. It can be no coincidence that you have been granted a few twilight years in which to reflect. You have earned a rest."
Orsef shook his head furiously.
"I have no use for rest, Lord Mephiston. Let me get my weapons."
He was about to limp away, but Mephiston held him back.
"I need your mind, Adamis, not your weapons. I need to know more about your home. I have come here on an urgent mission, but Divinus Prime is a mystery to me. I must learn the history of Mormotha and its construction. From what I have read, you have become this city's leading scholar, and you were always a man of great insight."
The old preacher looked pleasantly baffled by Mephiston's praise, but he smiled again.
"It does my old bones good to see you," he shrugged. "And I am something of a historical relic, I suppose. So perhaps I can assist you."
He waved at the building behind him.
"The Tomb of the Eremite is one of the oldest structures in the city, and our library contains some of the earliest records."
Mephiston's face remained as impassive as ever, but Antros could sense his pleasure at the old man's reply. Father Orsef shrugged, laughing quietly to himself.
"Strange days, strange days."
He shuffled back up the steps towards the porch and waved for them to follow.
"All are welcome at the Tomb of the Eremite."
He led them slowly through a series of candle-lit chapels and into a large refectorium. The long, Spartan room was mostly empty, with just a few monks sat eating in silence from wooden bowls. Then he paused and looked at Mephiston, unsure what to do next. Mephiston ordered Captain Vitrinus and his tactical marines to explore the city, acquaint themselves with its layout, and report back to him in the morning. Then he turned to Epistolary Racilus.
"Lexicanium Antros will be required to do more than observe in the days to come," he said. "We must accelerate his training."
Antros struggled not to grin, but Racilus looked appalled by the idea.
"My lord, is that wise?"
Antros could see the anger pouring out of him, and it was not hard to guess the reason. Racilus had been there in the chemic spheres. He heard Mephiston claim that Antros might bring about his doom. Racilus clearly did not trust him.
"Make him ready," said Mephiston. "He must master the rites listed in the glutted scythe before the return of the Archcardinal. You saw how much use Boltifier was. It will fall to the three of us to rid these people of heresy."
Racilus glared at Antros, but said no more. Zin spoke up.
"Forgive me, my lord, but I would like to see if I can find more news of the Archcardinal. I am most keen to speak with him. Perhaps he is already on his way back to the city,"
he said, looking at Cyriac. Cyriac nodded.
"It's possible. At the very least, we could ask if he has been seen by any of the new arrivals."
With that, Zin made the sign of the Aquila to Mephiston, and the two priests hurried away. Mephiston left the hall with Father Orsuf, and Antros was left facing Epistolary Racilus. Racilus flared his nostrils with displeasure, as though considering a stain on his armour. Then he looked to the courtyard outside the refectorium.
"Follow me, then," he said, and they headed out into the morning sun.
The square courtyard was surrounded by cloistered walkways, but there was no sign of any priests loitering in the shadows. At the centre of the courtyard, surrounded by faded mosaics, was a large tomb. It was a wicker-like mesh of femurs and ribs, and, like the rest of the surrounding architecture, the thing was beautifully made, the interlocking fossils woven into an intricate design that incorporated haloed saints and writhing nests of serpents. Racilus walked on, and indicated that Antros should sit on the mosaic floor. Antros did as instructed, but Racilus remained standing and drew his force sword. Antros could not entirely hide his surprise as Racilus rested the blade on the back of his neck, but he refused to flinch from the touch of the metal.
"We should be on Baal," said Racilus,
looking scornfully at the dusty courtyard that surrounded them.
"This is no place for me to teach you anything. We should be in the Chamber of the Ensanguined, at the heart of the 15th Basilica, surrounded by all the wisdoms of our forebears. But I am afraid you will have to imagine such glories, neophyte. If the chief librarian wishes me to teach you the imprecations of the glutted scythe, I must see whether your mind is ready for the next stage of its development. Rest assured, should you prove unworthy, my blade will spare you any shame."
"My lord," said Antros, "I am ready. Whatever the—"
"Then seek the fathomless path," whispered Racilus.
Antros's words faltered as he tried to understand what those words might mean. Then he realized he could not remember who had said them. He looked around in confusion, remembering that he was alone. The Carrion Sea stretched out as far as he could see, in every direction, fierce ember tides hissing and steaming as they belched plumes of smoke up to the blood-red sky. The deserts of Baal Secundus were uniformly infernal, but the Carrion Sea had a particularly fearsome reputation. Antros looked down at his patched-together rad suit and saw that it was beginning to shrivel and crack. What had possessed him to attempt this crossing? Then he remembered. The brutal, featureless landscape was broken by only one thing: the growling hulk of Isandroma. It looked like a wounded beast, hovering in the rippling heat and spitting oil across the ash.
"Ramael," he grunted. "I will kill you for this."
Antros staggered on through the thick, energy-sapping atmosphere and the shocking heat, ignoring the pain as his suit started to melt into his skin. His rebreather filtered out the worst of the fumes, but he still felt like he was breathing molten metal. The air burned in his lungs until he could hardly bear to take another breath, but still he lurched on. As he neared the sand roamer, he saw Ramael, struggling with the engine, attempting to wrench a part free before the fuel caught fire and took his face off.
"Ampelos!"
cried Ramael, staggering back from the truck, a broken axle in his fist.
"I told you we'd make it!"
Antros frowned. Of course his name was Ampelos. Where had he heard the name Antros? By the standards of the Blood Tribes, Ramael was a giant, thick-set and over 6 foot tall, with none of the wasted, stooping posture that marked out most of the tribesmen.
"Get your arse up here, Ampelos!" he cried,
climbing up into the driver's seat. Ampelos clambered over the top of an ash dune and tumbled down the other side. His tumble became a roll, and tongues of fire flashed in the folds of his thick, rubber suit. When he came to a halt at the bottom of the slope, he howled in annoyance and pain.
"Gah!
What made me ever listen to anything you ever said? Ever?
Because I always talk sense, grinned Ramael, as Ampelos climbed up beside him in the truck. And you know that once we've joined the tribe of the angels, you will thank me every day for getting us there.
Ampelos replied with a kidney punch that only succeeded in knocking more laughter from his brother.
We're almost there, said Ramael, his eyes widening behind his mask.
Angels fall! For throne's sake, think of it, Ampelos! We will see them!
They sat there, both picturing the scene. From their earliest childhood, they had whispered tales of crimson angels, giants who strode the deserts, armoured colossi, unaffected by radiation, afraid of nothing and no one. Heroes who waged war across the stars, crushing every tribe that defied them.
And when we complete the trials, they will take us to the Arx Angelicum, breathed Ramael, his voice rough with emotion. They will make angels of us.
From anyone else, Ampelos would have found this absurd, but he actually believed Ramael might get them to the mythical fortress of the Blood Angels. While still a youth, Ramael had butchered all his rivals and become the new Anxur Anuath of the Karor tribe. He was still in his teens, and his reputation was so fearsome that not one of the other blood tribes had raided their territories for nearly a year. Even the most stubborn elders of the Karor tribe had bent the knee.
"I think they just might," said Ampelos in a quieter voice,
buoyed by his brother's determination.
"We're going to do it, Ramael."
They both looked forwards, through the filthy windscreen. There was a massive, deep fissure before them, perhaps only 20 or 30 feet wide, but so deep that they could not see the bottom. Ampelos looked in either direction and could see no end to the crevasse. He was about to say something, to make one last plea for sense, when Ramael gunned the engines and they hurtled forwards. They both slammed back in their seats as the Sand Roamer raced towards the chasm, its six wheels trailing fumes and dust. Ramael steered the truck towards a natural ramp, a sloping lip of rock that jutted out over the drop. The wind howled through the truck as they sliced through the fumes and out across the void. They seemed to hang above the abyss. Ampelos felt all the seconds of his life collide. He knew that this jump was the fulcrum of everything that had been and everything that would come. Then, in that fractured moment, he saw the future. As in so many of his life's crucial moments, he saw, vividly, what lay ahead. Only one of them was going to be an angel. They were two-thirds of the way across when the undercarriage tore free. The Sand Roamer kicked to one side and then turned, end over end, in a slow, graceful tumble. When they came down on the other side, it was with a terrible grinding of tearing metal plates and escaping gas. A cold slap of agony exploded in Ampelos's face, and, for a few seconds, he knew nothing. Then he drew a flame-hot breath and howled in pain. He was lying a few feet away from the vehicle, his mask smeared with blood and his nose pulsing with furious pain. He looked around and saw the truck on its side.
"Ramael!" he cried.
Smoke was drifting around the base of the vehicle. Ramael had broken one of his legs free, but he could not lift the other from the wreckage. He was trapped.
"Ampelos!"
he howled, straining to free himself, his voice hoarse with agony. Ampelos staggered over to him, swaying and stumbling like a drunk, dazed from the crash. When he got there, he grabbed Ramael and hauled with all his strength. Ramael gasped in agony, and blood jetted from his thigh. Ampelos paused, horrified.
"Get me out!" cried Ramael. "Don't let me burn!"
There was no fear in his voice, only fury. Ampelos pulled again, but only succeeded in spraying more of his brother's blood into the air. Ramael's eyes rolled back in his head, and he seemed on the verge of passing out. Even through his mask, Ampelos could see that his brother's face was ghostly white. Ampelos groaned a curse as he saw flames licking around the fuel tanks.
"You are going to make it," said Ampelos. "I will not let you die."
Ampelos turned and looked into the heat haze. He saw, to his surprise, the figure of a man standing calmly in the heat of the desert. It was hard to be sure through the fumes, but it looked like a warrior of some kind. Ampelos could not see the stranger clearly, but he had no choice but to approach him. He would not simply stand by and watch Ramael die.
I'll be back,
he said, gripping Ramael's arm. Then he rushed towards the stranger. As he reached the man, the smoke rolled back and revealed such a glorious sight that Ampelos gasped. Standing near the edge of the chasm was an angel. It was clad in golden armour and had a pair of pure white wings folded behind its back. The angel's face was turned to the heavens as though in prayer, and its beautiful features were bathed in Baal's infernal, bloody light. All the fury of the Carrion Sea had been unable to touch this perfect being. Its polished armour was immaculate, with no sign of corrosion or dirt, and the flawless alabaster of its face radiated purity and health. At the sound of Ampelos's approach, the angel lowered its gaze and turned to face him. It was carrying a gilt-handled sword, and, as it stepped towards him through the drifting embers, Ampelos saw its face more clearly. His stomach turned, and his mouth filled with bile acid. Immediately, Ampelos sensed that something was wrong. The stranger's face was beautiful, but out of place. Ampelos could not understand how, but he knew that this figure should not be here. It was as though this moment had happened before, many years earlier, and memory told him that things should be different. The angel's face was incredibly beautiful, but such utter wrongness bled from it that Ampelos was terrified. He could barely summon words. All he managed to cry out was a strangled, "Wait!" The false angel smiled.
"You're human."
Its voice was as serene as its eyes were flawless.
"I'm Ampelos,"
he gasped, pulling back his rebreather, struggling to breathe.
"Of the Kruer tribe."
His skin blistered immediately, and he quickly refastened his hood, but the angel had seen enough to smile.
"What kind of fool walks through the Carrion Sea?" the angel asked, good-willed amusement written across its face.
Ampelos groaned in pain, struggling not to flee. He dropped to his knees, overcome by exhaustion and confusion.
"A fool, like my brother,"
he gasped, waving feebly at the trashed sand roamer behind him.
"I have to free him."
The false angel's face was transformed by mock concern, and it held out a hand to help him up.
"Do you?"
Ampelos dared not refuse the hand, and, as he climbed to his feet, he saw the angel's face close up. It was so clearly untrue that he thought his mind might break. Every atom of his being screamed in horror and revulsion.
"Yes,"
muttered Ampelos, talking more to himself than the stranger. Anger and pain tripped the words from his lips.
"Of course, we are destined to become angels."
The angel smiled sympathetically.
"It does not look like your friend would have done very well in the place of challenge, Ampelos. You must go to him. The fires nearly reached those fuel tanks. You must free him. Unless..."
The angel shrugged.
"Perhaps you have seen another future."
Ampelos reeled, filled with guilt.
"What do you mean?"
The false angel smiled again as its wings spread out behind it, refulgent and shimmering in the radioactive haze.
"You have seen the future. You know that only one of you will achieve the glory you seek. You wandered away because you saw that. If your brother dies, you will be that one.
Ampelos laughed derisively at the suggestion he would leave his brother to die on purpose. Words of refusal and denouncement circled his thoughts, but as he looked at the angel, he found he could say nothing. He knew that this moment should be different, that it had been different. The angel should not be here, questioning his motives like this.
"You are a lie!" he cried. "You are not here!"
Anger flashed in the stranger's eyes. It was gone as quickly as it came, but it was enough to trigger something in Ampelos. The rage he had seen in the angel's eyes reminded him of something. The idea grew in his mind. Suddenly, it seemed crucial that he remembered what the stranger's fury reminded him of. The false angel saw his hesitation, and the flash of anger returned. Ampelos frowned, and a word formed, unbidden on his lips.
Racilus?
With the word came a flood of images. The angel reared away with a frustrated howl, swallowed by a vortex of scenes that exploded from the air, and Antros recalled his true name again, his blood angel's name. Sensing he had achieved a victory of some kind, Antros dived after the angel. As the angel tumbled through the maelstrom of places and people, its golden armor dissolved into currents of color, washing up into Antros's face, blinding him as he swam in the angel's wake, calling out the name Racilus with increasing conviction. As the shapes gyrated around him, Antros saw Racilus appear ahead of him, stripped of his disguise as he plunged through the storm of light and pigment. Antros powered through the tumult after him, grasped Racilus's ankle, and hauled him towards the brightest of the lights, driven by some unexplained instinct. They were back in the courtyard, outside the refectorium. Everything was as it had been when Antros sat down. Racilus was still clutching his force sword, and the blade was sparking with empiric fury. Antros thought that Racilus was about to strike, and he stood up, backing away from him. Racilus stared at him, his eyes still blazing blue. Then he closed his eyes and lowered the sword, letting it clatter onto the stone tiles. He remained like that, eyes closed, his face a mask of concentration, until Antros spoke.
"My lord,"
Antros said,
"have I passed?"
"You let your brother die."
Antros's worst fears were confirmed. The false angel that had transposed itself onto his memory was Racilus. The old veteran had pried into Antros's past and seen Ramael's death.
"No," he insisted. "I was looking for help. I only left him for a moment."
"But then you hesitated?"
Racilus watched him closely. Antros looked away.
"Perhaps for the briefest moment, but nothing I could have done would have saved him."
Racilus shrugged.
"It does not matter to me, Antros, but I see it matters to you. You carry a great guilt, and guilt could cloud your judgment."
He leant closer.
"I have seen the hunger in you, the ambition to succeed. Now I know what feeds it. You are determined to prove yourself. You want to prove that your brother's death was fated, rather than being your fault. Isn't that true?"
Antros said nothing, and continued staring at the ground. Racilus nodded.
"I saw this shadow over you, and thought it was something worse." "We can complete your training, Antros. But know that I will be watching you always. I know you now."
Antros nodded. He did not doubt that for a second.
"Is there anything else I should know?"
asked Racilus, looking closely at Antros. Something about the exchange prompted Antros to speak more openly than he would usually dare.
"What do you know of Mephiston's gift? Of its origins, I mean.
Have you ever asked him what he really saw on Hades Hive? What kept him from dying beneath the rubble that day? Suspicion and anger crossed Rasselas's face. Then he sighed and nodded, adopting a more neutral expression.
A reasonable question. Calistaria survived that day and was reborn as Mephiston, because Sanguinius saw his most promising son dying and refused to let him go. He saw hope in Calistarius. He saw a soul so like his own that it could wield the power of a Primarch.
He looked up at the sky.
Mephiston's gift is the might of the angel.
How do you know all this?
I know it because I believe it. My faith in Mephiston is complete. I would follow him into any hell he chose without a moment's pause.
He leant close to Antros, his sapphire eyes flashing.
He will save us all.
Rasselas spoke with such passion that Antros felt ashamed for ever doubting the chief librarian, and he nodded, humbled by the fire in Rasselas's voice. Rasselas waited to see if Antros would push the matter any further. Then he lifted up a gold-edged porphyry box that was chained to his battleplate. Using a gold key, also chained to his power armour, he unlocked the box and slid out a small, leather-bound book.
"Read with me, Lexicanium," he said, addressing Antros by his correct rank for the first time. "And for throne's sake, concentrate! There are very few words in this book, but you could read it for a century and not catch its true meaning."
He gave Antros a warning glare.
"Whatever drives you, there are no shortcuts to true knowledge. This text rewards hard work and dedicated study. If the Emperor is willing, and you can forget your dead brother for a while, we will find out how great your talent really is."